The following presentation was recorded live by Voices from Jerusalem.
Okay, guys. Welcome back. We're getting to the end there. We're down to, I think, like six classes left. So you have the six, got the 500 years and six classes. Just a little bit of, since we're in a fast day today, the 10th of Tevis, okay, so it's definitely worth talking for a minute about the significance of fast days. It's a very important lesson for Jewish history. What the 10th of Tevis commemorates is the beginning of the end of Jerusalem in the First Temple period, the beginning of the siege, the Babylonian siege, which takes 10 years till the city actually falls. It's one of the four, excluding the 9th of Av, well, excluding actually Yom Kippur, one of the fast days that commemorate some sort of disastrous event in Jewish history. It's considered a minor fast as opposed to Tisha B'Av, which is a 24-hour fast, or Yom Kippur, which is a fast for totally different reasons. But we have to appreciate what I said very early on in the first class we had, that Jewish holidays, not just holidays, but fast days, are opportunities. Okay, there's a certain, in the case of a holiday, spiritual growth that you can tap into. In the case of a fast day, there's something we have to focus on. And clearly, fast days, first and foremost, besides remembering all the bad things that happened, we have to remember why they happened. That means, and to remember why they happened means there's an opportunity for tshuva, to rectify the mistakes we made in the past. So that's the big opportunity of any fast day, okay, is to do tshuva, to realize what's going wrong. And as it relates to Jewish history, besides the commemoration of the actual event, relates to a very important point that I've said many, many times, which you can see reflected in a number of the accounts that I've read of different disasters in Jewish history, that we have to always remember that what happens to us is because of what we do. We're responsible. History affects us the way we choose to act. And if you look at the way, as I've read you a couple of accounts already, but if you look at the way the Jews, and I'll show you a few more of them, even today we'll read one, the way we've always looked at why bad things happen to us, it's always because we've seen we're not doing the right thing. Okay, the solution to all of our problems, whether it means dealing with the Gentile, whether it's the Arab or the Nazi or whatever, has always to do with something that's off within us. So we really need to take this opportunity to focus on it, okay, and be very aware. That's one of the great lessons of Jewish history, is to learn from the mistakes of the past so we don't have to, God forbid, add any additional fast days into the Jewish calendar. We should all get to a point in Jewish history we don't have to keep them anymore. And they'll only be gotten rid of when we rebuild the temple and the Jewish people are spiritually holding what we're supposed to be holding. Okay, enough of that. I'd like to just pick up where we left off last time. Yeah?
You say it was 10 years before the temple?
No, two years of siege. The Babylonians besieged Jerusalem for 2 years before it falls. Okay, we left off at 1500, thereabouts. Excuse me, we got past that. We finished with the massacres of Tach V'Tach and Bogdan Chmelnytsky, the Chmelnytsky massacres, which again we see is a classic, there's something we could certainly have a fast day over, but a classic example of Jewish-Gentile interaction gone horrendously wrong, and what was a golden age comes crashing down. So if we're at around the year 1700, thereabouts, where's the Jewish world? Well, geographically we know that a lot of Jews have now moved to Eastern Europe. That's the easily a third, if not more, of the entire Jewish population of the world is now in the area of what is Eastern Europe, Poland, Ukraine. Even after the Chmelnytsky massacres, there's still going to be a very large Jewish community, even though 100,000 are going to be killed. But the whole atmosphere is going to be very different. We're going to have tremendous poverty now. Jewish morale is going to be very low. Many, many people have suffered tremendously. Communities have been destroyed. People are dislocated. When you wander around, a lot of people died, not just from being physically killed, but from having their houses burned and wandering around in the winter and starving to death. There's also a significant Jewish population in the Middle East still. It never disappears. And I want to sort of talk a few minutes about them before we go and talk about what is a very important topic at this period of time, which is the false Messiah, Shabtai Tzvi, and the reemergence of Kabbalah and Jewish mysticism. It's all related to what's going on in the Jewish world at this time. If you look on your timelines, you can see where we are. We're going to be doing the last two little parts of our suitcase over here. And again, it's important to understand the rise of mysticism is very much linked to the general spiritual state that the Jewish people are in. Let's put that on hold for a minute and just talk a little bit about the Middle East and what's going on. I mentioned we talked about Islam, that starting in 638 until 1917, the end of 1917, with the exception of the Crusades, meaning from 1099 to 1187, Israel is going to be ruled, as I mentioned before, by all these different Islamic dynasties. right? The Umayyads, the Abbasids, the Fatimids, the Seljuks, the Mamluks, the Ottomans. And the last people I want to talk about, because it's the last Muslim controllers of not just Israel, but a good percentage of the Middle East, of the Ottoman Turkish Empire. Remember, don't call Turks Arabs. They get very upset by that. I already mentioned, by the way, that in 1492, it's important. We want to understand the rise of Turkey in the context of this blessing given to Abraham. I'll bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. Remember, I mentioned that the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, the largest number of Jews goes to Portugal, right? And they don't have too good a time there. Within 5 years, they're going to be either forcibly converted or expelled. The second largest number of Jews, something like 60,000, is going to go to Turkey. Okay, as I remember I mentioned before, the Sultan saying, they tell me Ferdinand is a wise man, but he's a fool, for he takes all of his treasure and gives it to me. He's talking about the Jews. And there's no question in my mind that the rise of Turkey as a major world power in the 16th century corresponds to the influx of a huge number of Jews, obviously well-educated, with all the connections that Jews always have in Jewish history. In 1516, the Turks are going to come to Israel and conquer Israel. The walls we have around the city today, by the way, are built by Suleiman the Magnificent. You know, the builder of the first temple is Solomon. The Muslim builder of the walls, Suleiman, same name, right? The Muslims love Jewish names. Dawood, you know, all these different guys. Suleiman, you name it, they have it. Jibril, as we've seen before. So not only do we have Jews going to Turkey, but Turkey now expands and is going to incorporate the land of Israel. This is definitely, for the Jewish people, the beginning of the reemergence of the Jewish community, which is not going to happen overnight. The Turkish Empire is going to vacillate tremendously. It goes up in the 16th century. During Suleiman's time, it does tremendously well. As a matter of fact, Turkey, as I mentioned before, gets all the way to the gates of Vienna, Austria. In the early 16th century, they're defeated outside Austria, and they're also in a major sea battle. Lepanto, I believe, with the defeat of a Venetian fleet, basically destroys the Turkish fleet. So they almost, we have the second attempt by the Muslim world. We have much earlier on, we see they almost do it much earlier on, the 8th century, the Battle of Tours, right? Poitiers, right? That's, I've been told, correct. It's a good thing to have you here. I have all the French things down accurately now. In the 8th century, we have in the 16th century. Okay, 800 years later, the Muslim world tries again. They are stopped. But Turkey is going to remain, for the 16th century, undeniably the greatest power in the world. Okay, military power, expanding tremendously. And the Turks, as we saw already, because they let Jews in, have a generally very tolerant, as Muslims go, and I mentioned this before, Turkey is a country that's been very historically nice to the Jews, and have a very tolerant attitude towards Jews. And Jews are going to start to move back into the land of Israel because of that. So again, we see a great example of sort of the door slamming shut in the face of the Jews in one part of the world and opening in another. Now, one of the places doors are going to open up is Israel, and within Israel, it's the community of Sfat. You guys been to Sfat? Sfat's a place which is still till this day not very well rebuilt. It was destroyed by a bad earthquake in the 19th century. There's been a lot of earthquakes in Israel, believe it or not. And the Jewish community was actually, as in most places in the land of Israel, quite small. In the 15th century, not a very large Jewish community. About 300 families. But by the 16th century, by the mid-16th century, the Jewish community of Sfat is going to explode. Now, the mid-16th century is corresponding to a large exodus of Jews out of Spain to many different parts of the world, including a tremendous number are going to try and come back to Israel. Not the largest number by far, but a lot will come back. And Sfat, the population of Sfat is going to go from 300 families to, by the mid-16th century, it's going to be 10,000 Jews living in Sfat. That's an incredible number of people, considering that the whole rest of the country, I'm sure, didn't have anywhere near that many Jews living in it. So it's a big upsurge of Jewish population. The first printing, by the way, the first printing press in the Middle East is in Sfat in 1573. So it shows you what a vibrant community it was. And along with the influx of Jews into Sfat is going to be the golden age of Judaism in Sfat, which we associate with, for you guys who've been to Sfat, we know this is the real mystical place one goes to, right? It still is a magnet for mystics and a lot of weird people too. If you ever go to Sfat, there's lots of interesting people, I use interesting, you know, parenthetically, wandering around Sfat. Very interesting mix. And it goes all the way back to the association we have with Sfat as sort of the center of mysticism. Let's stop and talk a little bit about what's going on in terms of Jewish mysticism, because today mysticism is a huge thing, not just in the Jewish world in general. I mean, you have like this Kabbalah Center in L.A. where really big Jews like Madonna go and learn Kabbalah, and Roseanne Barr, who actually is Jewish. Of course, you know, this is not really the Jewish idea about who's supposed to learn in Kabbalah. Kabbalah is something that one only learns when one is seriously grounded in Torah. You're not supposed to even touch it till you're 40. 40 meaning not that you became Baal Tshuva at 36. 40 meaning you've been learning since you're 3, and now you've mastered all of Torah, and now you're ready to go into the deeper, more esoteric stuff. But today, since people want a quick fix, and because, you know, unfortunately for television and Americans, especially have an attention span of about 30 seconds, they need instant spirituality. So, which? People are looking for spirituality. An interesting topic, why everyone is, definitely part of the Jewish worldview as we come close to the end of days, no question. But people don't have the patience to do it correctly, so they want to go, it's sort of like jumping into Kabbalah when you can't even read the Aleph Beis is sort of like, I want to learn, you know, astrophysics from Albert Einstein when I can't even do 1 plus 1 is 2. And anyone who knows anything about astrophysics, you need serious grounding in mathematics and science before you can jump to that. But Kabbalah in general, I mean, there's two forms of Kabbalah, and I'm not an expert on this at all. This is something I know actually very little about. But there are two kinds of Kabbalah. There is the sort of practical Kabbalah, which is what I mentioned, you know, creating, taking, you know, like lumps of mud, making human, you know, golems out of them, like the Golem of Prague, that kind of story. Manipulating, it's sort of like manipulating the forces of nature. No one knows how to do that today. That's something that is a lost skill, thank God. Can you imagine? Like you buy your Edmund Scientific Kabbalah kit and try and make a golem, you know? You can, however, buy Aryeh Kaplan's book on Sefer Yetzirah, which is translated, and it's how to create animate life. You know, I can promise you can spend your whole life doing it. You will not be successful. But if anyone's really interested in the topic, they have a nice translation from Aryeh Kaplan on it. The other kind of Kabbalah is the Kabbalah which people tend to study today, those people who study it correctly and those people who study it incorrectly, which is an understanding on a deeper mystical level of what is going on, trying to put the current historical experiences into the mystical understanding of what's going on in the universe. That is something that is very much alive and well and has become much more popular in the last number of centuries. And certainly in the last 2 years, with this big upsurge in interest in mysticism, people want to get to the cool, mystical, spiritual stuff. So what we have going on in Tzfat is not people trying to make golems. Okay, we have people trying to put deeper meaning into the very bad historical experiences of the Jewish people that are happening at this period of time. We're talking about after 1600 years of diaspora, of expulsions from virtually every single place, of slaughters of Jews, of forced conversion. So people were looking for deeper meaning. And the origins of Jewish mysticism go all the way back to Torah. Along with the Torah that we get at Mount Sinai, the written Torah is a mystical tradition that follows us all the way through. And because of the nature of that, it's very esoteric and hard to understand. It is not something that the common Jew studied for many, many, many centuries in Jewish history. We say, by the way, traditionally, that the basic work of Kabbalah we know is what book? What does everyone study? Zohar, right. And the Zohar is the work of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Okay? It doesn't mean he invented it. He revealed it. So he had a mystical tradition. The story is that he, during the time of the Roman occupation of Israel in the second century of the Common Era, when there was Hadrianic persecutions, when the Romans were hunting down Jews and forbidding the teaching of Torah, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai goes into hiding in a cave, okay, for 12 years. And during that time, very interesting, I don't want to go into the details of the story, but during that time, he formulates the Zohar. He comes up with it. Okay, and the Zohar is not spread after that. We don't have a big explosion of teaching of mysticism. It stays hidden. It appears as a book basically in the 13th century in Spain. The person who's credited with being the modern revealer, author of the Zohar is Rabbi Moshe de Leon. Okay? Now, many Bible critics, people who attack the Bible, like to say that he really made it up, because it contains words that are like, you know, medieval Spanish are in there. Obviously, Shimon Bar Yochai didn't know medieval Spanish. It's actually a nonsense attack against the notion of it being very ancient. All it is saying is that Rabbi Moshe de Leon, who puts out his version of it, is merely adding in his own language and understanding, and some of it creeps into the text. But the traditional Jewish understanding is that it is very old work. Okay, it's been circulating around the Jewish world. That comes from the Middle East in around the 10th century, 11th century, Kabbalah crosses over from the Middle East into Europe. The people that are associated with the spread of Kabbalah into Europe are Rabbi Chai Gon, the last of the Gonim in Babylon, and Rabbeinu Kolomonius. Okay, so we see the Kabbalah is hanging out in the Middle East, makes it right before the Crusades, the end of the Gaonic period, into Europe. stays hidden, and then appears in around the 13th century via the auspices of this guy, Rabbi Moshe de Leon. His dates, by the way, are 1250 till 1305, I believe. Okay. Now, again, we don't have a huge explosion of Kabbalah at this period of time. It more or less is not something you hear too much about. But once you get to the 16th century in Sfat, then it's all going to really come out in a big way. And it's definitely tied to big events, especially the expulsion from Spain. Okay, expulsion from Spain being such a disastrous event led a lot of Jews to say, what's going on? You know, what's God doing to us? How do we understand the events of history and our place in history? So there's going to be a big upsurge in Kabbalah centering on Sfat and centering about a bunch of people who I'm sure you've all heard of. The most important is Rabbi Isaac Luria, 1534 to 1572, who's known as the Arizal. Okay, you've heard of the Ari? You can go to Sfat. They have the Ari Ashkenaz Synagogue, which wasn't even built when he was around. It's built on the place where, have anyone been there to Sfat? You can see, you've been, that's the place which is outside of the city where he used to go, because one of the innovations of the Jewish community of Sfat in the 16th century was Kabbalah Shabbos, Lechadodi, which is also written by, I talk about a rabbi who wrote that in Sfat. So the Ari is by Moshe de Leon, who is a big scholar who came to Sfat to study with Moshe Cordovero. People heard of Moshe Cordovero, a little less known. He is 1534 to 1572. No, excuse me. I don't have Moshe Cordovero's dates here. That's the Ari's dates. So he comes to study with this big Kabbalist, and a whole large number of Kabbalists are going to come to Sfat to learn and to spread Kabbalah. So we're going to have a big upsurge in not just the size of the community, but in the study of mysticism. So this is the golden age of Sfat. Now again, I'm not going to go into too much detail on it, because it's a huge topic, which again, I do not know a lot about the inner workings of Kabbalah, but it's very important in terms of its, as a reaction to what's going on historically in the Jewish world, and it's also going to be very important in terms of the reaction to the spread of Kabbalah, which is going to be very significant. There's going to be a big move towards mysticism. We're going to see, because of Shabtai Tzvi in just a couple of minutes, a big backlash against the study of mysticism, and people feeling it's misleading the Jews and taking them in the wrong way. Along with, and the reason why there's a reaction against Kabbalah, along with the spread of mysticism, what always comes with mysticism, besides people looking into a lot of things they maybe shouldn't be looking into, mysticism is always associated with messianic expectation. Okay? Like all the mystical things, like the wheels of this, the different spherot, you know, are working in the heavens, and God has some secret plan we don't see, which is about to come into place, so people are going to expect the Messiah, and messianic expectation, as we'll see in just a couple minutes, can lead to big problems for the Jewish people. Okay, so besides Moshe Cordovero and Isaac Luria, there are a couple of other people who are very significant associated with this period of time. One is Rabbi Yaakov Beirav. He's very significant because his dates, by the way, 1475 to 1546. He's very significant because he tries to do something which hasn't been done in the Jewish world for well over 1,000 years. He tries to reinstitute smicha, rabbinic ordination. I mentioned that already in the second century, rabbinic ordination ceases. Proper rabbinic ordination from teacher to student, from Moses, going all the way back to Mount Sinai. The Roman persecutions become so intense, they stop during the second century of the Common Era. Yaakov Beirav feels that now that there's such a high concentration of incredibly learned Jews in Sfat, and a resurgence of a Jewish population, looks like it's the rebirth of, you know, a Jewish community in Israel, even 10,000 Jews, that it's time to reinstitute smicha. He will give smicha to himself and to one other person, Rabbi Yosef Karo, who's a very significant person we're going to look at in just a minute. It stops because other rabbis, primarily in Jerusalem, say, like, no way. You can't do this now. We're not ready for this. So two guys get smicha in the last over 1,000 years, and then the institution stops again. And again, the rabbinic ordination that is given out today is merely much more symbolic and based on sort of like getting a BA. You've accomplished a certain amount of learning, but it doesn't mean, like, back then you have like direct transmission of Torah from student to teacher. Yeah. Okay, first Max, in a second.
Yeah. So these two rabbis, gentlemen back then, decided to reinstitute smicha and deem themselves rabbis, but why do we hold that they are if the connection has been lost for like, what, 2,000 years, you said?
Not quite, but since the second century, until the 16th century. So, okay. Talking about.
So how can we consider that they haven't?
No, they don't. First of all, they're rabbis. Like, I got the title also. I mean, rabbi doesn't. We don't consider it was like an attempt which was not accepted, and therefore didn't happen.
So they're not considered rabbis.
No, no, no. They have the they're not considered. Do they have proper smicha? As in, that's a good question. I don't know whether. I don't believe we consider they really did it because the Jewish world did not accept it. He thought he could do it.
Wasn't Maimonides one who said that you couldn't use the term rabbi until the Sanhedrin was
approved? Right. So people use it anyway. And when we do, as you say correctly, when we do have the Sanhedrin, then we can reconstitute all of these institutions again. You can put all this back in place again. But obviously, what they were trying to do is ultimately to reconstitute the Sanhedrin. Let's give enough guys smicha. Let's make a Sanhedrin, and then we'll put all the basic Jewish institutions back into place. It obviously wasn't the time. There was potential there, but it wasn't actualized. Sorry, the question?
Question.
Oh, okay. Okay. But the person I really want to talk about is a very significant person who is a mystic, but also a tremendous Torah scholar who has a huge impact on the Jewish world, is Rabbi Yosef Caro, whose dates are 1488 to 1575. He's someone who was expelled from Spain during the expulsion. And he has a very interesting trip. He goes via, I believe, he goes to Amsterdam, he ends up in Turkey, he ends up in Israel. And he goes to Sfat. And he's one of the guys who's involved in Jewish mysticism, a very significant person. But much more important is his impact on Jewish law. In Turkey, they started a work of halacha called the Arbaturim, which was Rabbi Yaakov ben Asher, who was from Spain in the 14th century. It's a major work of Jewish halacha, which Rabbi Yosef Caro is going to write a commentary on, which is going to take him over 32 years to write. It's called the Beis Yosef. Okay, it's a tremendous work of Jewish scholarship, putting together all practical application of Jewish law. Okay, so the Beis Yosef is his commentary on the Arbaturim. Later, Rabbi Yosef Caro is going to condense it down into a shorter version called the Shulchan Aruch. Okay, and the Shulchan Aruch is a very, people have heard this book, Shulchan Aruch, it means set table. Shulchan Aruch is one of the most significant works of Jewish law. Okay, because what we have now is, at this period of time, once you get to 1500 and thereafter, which is right at the period of time of his life, you have the real falling apart of any central Jewish community. Spain is gone, Jews are really scattered everywhere, a lot of Jews are moving to Eastern Europe. Okay, the real danger exists of the Jewish community adopting different forms of observance that would split the community irrevocably. And you'd have different versions of Judaism, just like the Christian church split. Okay, and then you have different versions of Judaism, and the whole Jewish people could fall apart. It could be a potential disaster. So what Yosef Caro does is he puts together, again, a shorter version of his Beis Yosef work, more or less. I'm not really doing justice in this explanation, which is going to become the basic text for application of Jewish law. Any of you guys, God willing, you stick around, you make it to Smicha, rabbinic ordination, this is the book you study. It's an incredible work of scholarship, and what's more amazing is the fact that it was accepted. Because if it hasn't been accepted, then who knows what the Jewish people would have become? Who knows what would have kept? Yeah?
Since there's so much dispersion of the Jewish people, who is the authority to actually accept this as a...
Who is the authority? Excellent question. It's very interesting. You see, Jewish history and... In terms of what is accepted and who is accepted, is very interesting. It's a meritocracy. Like if you ask physicists, who's the greatest physicist of modern history? Almost everyone will say who?
Einstein.
Albert Einstein. There's a couple people close behind. You know, Stephen Hawking is way up there. But Albert Einstein pretty much hands down gets it. There was never a vote in human history to make Albert Einstein greatest physicist in the history of physics. Why does he have the position? It's in recognition of his genius as an accomplishment, right? We see that. Very similar in the Jewish world. The Gadol Hador, wherever he is in Jewish history, you can have many more contemporary, Rabbi Moses Feinstein, who died something like about 15 years ago, a little less than 13 years ago. He was considered by everyone, in terms of halacha, to be the Gadol Hador. There was never a vote. It was just in recognition of his absolute genius and the fact that everyone accepted him because it's not an ego thing. It's one of the great side tributes to Jewish people and our incredible desire for truth, that when it comes to recognizing great people and great works, it's always based on an objective appreciation of who those people and who those works are. So when greatness comes into the world, just as you see with a guy like Einstein, it's just recognized. He's the guy. You don't take a vote on it, even though he never had a PhD in physics, had no official position when he came up with the theory of general relativity working in a Swiss patent office. He wasn't a professor at Princeton University, as he would be later in life. You know, so it's the same kind of thing. We see that when people see a work like this, there's an immediate recognition that this is genius. Now, by the way, it doesn't always work that way. A guy like Maimonides, as I mentioned previously, when he comes up with his work, the Mishneh Torah, it's quite a long period of time before people will accept it because of what he says about his work, and it's considered controversial. But ultimately, when people are able to cool down and look at what it is, they realize how tremendous it is. So it's not always like an instantaneous recognition. It's a process. But people saw the Shulchan Aruch and they realized that it was clearly this is a work of tremendous scholarship which the Jewish people desperately need. We need a central work of legal text that we can base observance of modern practical application of Jewish law on. Now, as I mentioned before, Rabbi Moses Isserles is going to write his commentary, which appears today alongside the Shulchan Aruch. It's Mechaber. He's called the Ramah. Okay, I mentioned his name previously. His is the Ashkenazic, like footnotes to Rabbi Yosef Karo, who we call the Mechaber, meaning the author's text. Meaning, when the Ashkenazi world got their hands on it, they said, yeah, this is basically correct, but let's add in our own local customs to slightly modify what the text is. And as I mentioned, his work, the Ramah's work, is called the Mapah, which is the set table. So what do you put on the Shulchan Aruch? The Mapah is the tablecloth. You put on the Shulchan Aruch, the set table, the tablecloth. And the two of them go together. And if you read any, you open up the Shulchan Aruch today, open up the Mishnah Brewer. You'll see. The Mishnah Brewer is merely the Chafetz Chaim's commentary on Aruch Chaim, on daily Jewish law, and you'll see it contains the text of the Shulchan Aruch in regular Hebrew, within smaller Rashi script. You'll be able to read the Ramah, so you know this is the Ashkenazic commentary on it. But it's a very, very significant work. You can see right over here in our little timeline, we have Torah becomes more accessible, we have our three greats over here, bam, bam, bam. Rashi, right, his amazing commentary on the Chumash, on the Talmud. Maimonides, codifying, organizing all of Jewish law in the Mishnah Torah. And last but certainly not least, Rabbi Yosef Karo, who puts together Shulchan Aruch. Yes, Jeff. Kitzur Shulchan Aruch is a much more recent variation on the theme of daily Jewish law. There's several books that have a similar title. It's not the exact same thing. This is Kitzur Shulchan Aruch from Divrei Mishnah Brewer. It's a much more recent book, which, by the way, you have to be careful when using it because some of it is not so applicable. But if you want more information, I'll tell you about it afterwards. Okay, so this comes out, by the way, I don't know why I have 1488 over here, because that's maybe his date. The date it comes out is generally traded about 1564, so it's right about the middle of the 16th century. So what do we have in Spot? We have tremendous creativity, mystical creativity, and tremendous legal creativity. Unfortunately, by the way, it doesn't last because the Turkish Empire is really a flash in the pan in terms of its greatness. It will survive all the way up. The Ottoman Turkish Empire survives until World War I. By that time, it's already called the sick man of Europe. It was basically being propped up by the French and the British, because Turkey sits on one of the most important pieces of real estate on the planet Earth, the Hellespont, the Dardanelles, okay, which is that little waterway, which if you want to come out of like the Black Sea, etc., and get into the Mediterranean, you have to go through this very narrow little passage, sort of like the Straits of Gibraltar, very significant, but this is much narrower, which means that to keep Russia bottled up and not get into the Mediterranean, you got to prop up the Turks. I don't want to get into Turkish history, but they go into decline very significantly, and the general situation, we see that just as in Rome in the 3rd century, when Rome goes through a period of rapid, you know, turnover of emperors every year, a new emperor, there's a lot of lawlessness and pandemonium in the empire. It's not good for anyone. So too, when the Ottoman Turkish Empire goes into decline after Suleiman already, we're not talking about so late in history, we're talking about right after Suleiman goes, the Turkish Empire goes into decline. The general, in the outlying parts of the empire, like in Israel and Egypt, there's a lot of instability. There's going to be a lot more lawlessness and bandits and robbers and highwaymen, and the situation here economically is therefore going to decline, and the Jewish community of Sfat is going to fizzle out again. Okay, it's going to come back again in history, as we see, but the golden age of Sfat is going to last for a very short period of time. But out of it's going to come a tremendous amount of creativity. A couple of other names, by the way, that are associated with Sfat. If you take a nice tour of Sfat, you'll come across these people. Rabbi Chaim Vital. Okay, 1543 to 1620, very famous Kabbalist this period of time. Rabbi Shlomo Halevi Alkovitz, who is the guy who wrote Lecha Dodi. And as a matter of fact, if you look at Lecha Dodi, just as the whole Lecha Dodi service is an innovation of the mystical community of Sfat. You ever know what the Kabbalah Shabbat service is, right? You know, what we do before.
When did that become accepted as part of it?
As to how it spreads and how fast, I do not know. I don't know. But I gather it's been around most of the Jewish world for a very long period of time, for hundreds and hundreds of years. So it seems to have spread pretty quickly. The influence of the Jewish community of Sfat is very, very big throughout the Jewish world, both mystically and legally. If you look at, by the way, the beginning of Lecha Dodi, it's an acronym. I mean, every verse spells out, it spells out Shlomo Halevi. I look at the first of each verse. That's why when I first wanted to learn how to say it, Baal Peh, without reading it from a Siddur, I just remembered it was Shlomo Halevi, and it was Shamor v'Zachor, and so, you know, so if you remember that, that's where it comes from. Rabbi Moshe Alshich, who has a very nice synagogue you can go by also in Tzfat, who is not one of the inner circle of Kabbalists, but is a very significant mystic in his own right, and also wrote a very important commentary on the Bible, which you can read, the Alshich. So we have a lot of what's going on here. And Tzfat is very, very impactful on the entire Jewish world. And again, it doesn't last. But it's important to keep in mind, by the way, that mysticism is not just this period of time. I mentioned Nachmanides, the Ramban, in the 13th century. Okay, we already see, if you read his commentary, which is fantastic, especially on one of the best things you want to read, you want to get a real taste of mysticism, in the book of Genesis, the first Torah portion of Genesis, read someone like Nachmanides, the Ramban, and he puts a lot of mysticism. So you already see it's definitely in the Jewish world. It just peaks out at this period of time. Before we go talk about Shabbatai Tzvi, I want to just mention a couple of other Jewish communities that are important. Do we have anyone from Holland here? No Dutch people here. So I mentioned that when the Jews leave Spain, where they go, we talk about Portugal, some go to Italy, many go to Holland. Okay, Italy and Holland are going to become, if you know your history, this is late Renaissance here. If you know your history of both Italy and Holland, this is the golden age of what are two rather, not very big countries, especially Holland, but they're going to become, in terms of mercantile trade, very, very significant powers, especially naval powers. And there's no question that the rise of, especially of Holland, but certainly of Italy, but especially of Holland, is linked to a large influx of Jews who are going to go from Spain into Holland. Remember, we're going to see Holland as a country that's going to be a Spanish province. It's going to rebel. In 1581, they're going to rebel against Spain, and the actual independence of Holland is only going to be recognized at the end of the 30 Years' War, which I mentioned previously in 1648. Holland becomes an independent country. But a large number of Jews are going to move into there, and a large number, and because there's a large number of Jews, a lot of Muranos are going to go back, by the way. One of the most significant Muranos in Jewish history, we talk about the reemergence of the Jewish community in England, is a guy by the name of Israel, Menashe ben Israel, who was from a Morano family. You guys know the term Morano, right? Who is going to go to Holland, and now that he's outside of Catholic Spanish control, he's going to reconvert, so to speak, come back to Judaism, and he's going to be one of the main guys who in the 17th century is going to go to Oliver Cromwell in England and convince the English to take the Jews back into England. It's very interesting. So you have Jews moving back into these communities. Holland goes through a golden age in the 17th century. Okay, if you know your history of America, you know originally New York is New Amsterdam. Okay, it's a Dutch trading colony. Little teeny Holland had a huge empire in Africa. They got all the way out to the Far East. They had, in World War II, the Japanese were grabbed a couple of Dutch colonies out there because of their oil fields. And the major institution that is involved in the rise of Dutch mercantile trade is the Dutch West Indian Company. You ever heard of this institution, Dutch West Indian Company? Which by the way, had a lot of Jews on it. The Dutch West Indian Company is like a trade monopoly designed to oversee Dutch colonial interests wherever they were in the world. And there's a lot of Jews involved in trade. Okay, and as Jews always were involved in human history. So Jews going out to the Far East, once they go to Holland, they become very big, significant in trade. And there's no question that Holland's rise as a major maritime power is going to be due to the Jews. As a matter of fact, in the 17th century, you remember the story, who is the mayor of New Amsterdam before it becomes a British colony? A guy by the name of Peter Stuyvesant. You guys heard of Peter Stuyvesant? He had like a wooden leg. Peter Stuyvesant was a big anti-Semite. He wanted to expel the Jews from New York. Can you imagine throwing the Jews out of New York in the 17th century? Oh my God, where do they get bagels from? And because of Jewish economic impact in the Dutch West Indian Company, the Dutch West Indian Company basically told them, no way, you're not doing it. So it's a very interesting little side chapter in Jewish history. So that's like a brief just snippet of information about Jews in Holland. It's, in terms of Jews in the Sephardic world in general, the whole Sephardic world, with the exception of this golden age of Sfat, since the Crusades, the Arab world, the Muslim world, has gone into decline economically, and in many ways it did not develop. If you look at the modern history of the West, you see that the West has gone through the Dark Ages, to the Renaissance, to the Reformation, to the Enlightenment, to the industrialization, to democratization, right? All of that stuff has brought the Western world to be, right, the most dominant power in modern history in the world, clearly. The Arab world, once the Crusades hit, goes into tremendous decline and never really recovers. You do have bursts of light, like in Turkey for a little period of time. But it goes into tremendous decline. And it's pretty much been on the retreat until the point where you have today, you have no industrialized Arab country. You have no democratized Arab country. You have really no freedom of speech in the Arab world. And that's, it's a, pretty much a fact. If you want to read an interesting book on this, you can read David Price Jones. He wrote a book called The Closed Circle. And he talks about how the Arab world has been trapped in a very viciously destructive, self-destructive pattern that it has not been able to break out of. And the reason I'm mentioning it is not to go into Islamic history anymore, but because it has a huge impact on the Jews. Because the, as the Islamic world stagnates and becomes more reactionary and more and very anti-Western, and we have an increase in Islamic anti-Semitism during this period of time for sure, 11th century onward, big decline, it's going to impact the Jewish community. We're not going to see a lot of great stuff coming out of the Jewish world in the Middle East. There's definitely going to be exceptions. There's definitely personalities I mentioned, you know, people like Maimonides coming from Spain and Nachmanides, who also comes from that part of the world, and the Golden Age of Sfat. But more or less, the whole Middle East and the Jewish community that is within it is going to be sort of a sideshow. Much of the rest of the Jewish history we're going to do, until we get to the modern history of Israel, when we're back in the Middle East again, is going to be pretty much talking about the Ashkenazi Jewish world. Because just as Western Europe is going to really take off, so too is the Jewish community going to be where most of the things are happening. Tremendous percentage of population is going to be there. A lot of Jewish creativity is going to be there. So much of what we're going to do until we get to Zionism is going to be focused on European history. The last thing I want to talk about while we have time is Shabtai Tzvi. Okay, and he's the last little guy on our little time chart here. If you look where Shabtai Tzvi comes in, we're talking about in the mid-17th century. And now that we have all the background behind us, we can see how bad the situation in the Jewish world is by the mid-17th century. Okay, we've experienced the expulsion from Spain, the expulsion from everywhere in Europe, the ghettoization of most of the Jewish communities of Europe, the mass immigration into Poland, and the massacres of Tach V'Tach in 1640 and 1649. So pretty much by the mid-17th century, the Jews have been, you know, it's called been there, done that, and not been able to find any place for our foot to rest comfortably. Okay, so we've suffered through tremendous economic persecution, massive number of expulsions. The morale of the Jewish people is going to be very low. Okay, so that's, we have number one factor to throw in. Number two, we see, along with that, we already talked about the rise of mysticism. Okay, people are looking to try and understand what's going on. When's the end in sight? When's the Messiah going to come, right? Messianic expectations, I mentioned before, is a fundamental part of Jewish worldview. We always believe the Messiah is around the corner. And as I said before, when we talked about Christianity, it's always darkest before the dawn. Okay, you always find a rise in Messianic expectation when the situation in the Jewish world is the worst, which, as I mentioned previously, we talked about, you know, Judeo-Christians and the Dead Sea sect. We're talking about jumping back in history all the way back to the first and second centuries. You have a huge rise in Messianic expectation during the Roman occupation. And so too now in the 17th century, we're going to have a huge rise in Messianic expectation. Now, there have been a lot of false messiahs in Jewish history. Lots and lots and lots of them. As I mentioned previously, Jesus, from the Jewish perspective, certainly as a false messiah in human history, he, along with Muhammad, for the Gentiles, has been awesomely successful. But for the Jewish people, neither Jesus nor Muhammad was they're both flashes in the pan. They didn't get too many followers. A guy by the name of Shabtai Tzvi is going to be a far bigger guy in Jewish history in terms of impacting religious Jews into believing that he is the one. Now, Shabtai Tzvi is born in Smyrna, Turkey in 1626. He was very brilliant. By the age of 20, he's already given the title of Chacham by the Sephardic community. Even today, they call Rabbi Ovadia Yosef. They call him Chacham Ovadia. That's like the Sephardi term of honor and respect given to someone who's achieved a level of learning. He's very bright, very charismatic, and apparently emotionally stable, unstable, because not too long after he's given the title Chacham, he was thrown out of the community of Smyrna for being basically crazy. And he starts to wander around the world, okay, primarily in the Middle East. Now, in 1651, he makes it to Gaza. Now, keep in mind, this is a couple of years after the Khmelnytsky massacres. We're talking about the bottoming out of Jewish morale in the world. Just persecution after persecution. There seems to be no light at the end of the tunnel. In 1651, he ends up going to Israel, going to Gaza, meeting a Kabbalist by the name of Nathan of Gaza. Nathan was obviously a great PR guy, because Nathan manages to convince Shabtai Tzvi that he is, in fact, the Messiah. And he starts sending letters all over the world proclaiming that he's basically the Messiah. Nathan is PR guy. This is the Messiah is here, he's come. And he actually has a very significant percentage, I want to read you a very interesting letter here, has a very significant percentage of Jews believing he is, in fact, the one. Now, there's a woman by the name of Gluckel of Hamelin. Fantastic book, by the way. She wrote memoirs. Gluckel of Hamelin lived in the 17th century in Hamelin in Germany. You've heard of the Pied Piper of Hamelin? This is Gluckel of Hamelin. Not a great name to have, Gluckel, but a very significant person. She outlived two husbands. She had, I believe, 12 or 14 children. And besides being a widower and raising a humongously huge family in a not very pleasant place in Germany in the 17th century, she was a tremendous businesswoman. She was a very wealthy woman. She ran a huge trading business. She basically inherited her husband's business when he died and took it over. She wrote memoirs that are fascinating, gives you tremendous insight as a great primary source for Jewish history. She talks about what Jewish life was like at this period of time in Europe. And I want to read you an account of what she talks about. It's fascinating. Look at how she describes what's going on, and look at how she describes the Jewish people's reaction to Shabtai Tzvi. About this time, people began to talk of Shabtai Tzvi, but woe unto us that we have sinned and never lived to see what we heard and nigh believed. Throughout the world, my servants and children rent themselves with repentance, prayer, and charity. For 2, yea, for 3 years, thy beloved people Israel sat in labor, like they're about to give birth. It's always referred to as the birth pangs of the Messiah. But there came forth naught but wind. Instead of giving birth, we passed gas. You know, very interesting. Our joy when the letters arrived from Smyrna is not to be told. Most of them were addressed to Sephardim. Interesting, this is a Sephardic community in Germany. We see the refugees of Spain. As fast as they came, they took the letters to the synagogue and read them aloud. Young and old, the Germans too hastened to the Sephardic synagogues. All the Ashkenazim were running in to hear about the Messiah. Many sold their houses and lands and all their possessions for the day they hoped to be redeemed. My good father-in-law left his home in Hamelin, abandoned his house and lands and all of his goodly furniture. Full well we know the Most High has given his word, and were we not so wicked but truly pious from the bottom of our hearts, I am certain God would have mercy on us. If only we kept the commandment, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. But God forgive us for the way we keep it. No good can come from the jealousy and footless hate that rules our lives. Nevertheless, thou, Lord our God, has promised thou will like a gracious king fulfill. So it's very interesting what she's saying. First of all, that a majority of the Jewish communities, not a majority, but thousands of Jews are into Shabtai Tzvi. They believe the letters they're reading. That's interesting, number one. And look what happens, it doesn't happen. And you don't hear Gluckel of Hamelin, who's very typical in her mindset for the day, saying, oh, this is not fair, where is God, I give up. But saying, what's she say? It's because of what we're doing. We're not doing our part of the bargain. God is not redeeming us. If only we do what we're supposed to do. And look what she focuses on, by the way. Remember, Second Temple destroyed by causeless hatred? He says, if only we kept the commandment of love thy neighbor as thyself, we wouldn't be sitting in the situation we're sitting in. So here you see a very interesting reaction. Yeah. Hold on 1 second, I'm going to get to it right now. Okay, so what does Shabtai go to? He goes on, and in the early 1560s, he starts to... Now, originally, a lot of people thought he might be the one. He was a big Torah scholar, very charismatic. People believed him. Sorry, in the early 1660s, excuse me. Then he starts to do things which are totally not kosher. He abolishes the 17th of Tammuz, the fast, and Tisha B'Av. I'm the Messiah. We don't have to mourn anymore. He starts to change Jewish law. Okay, now, Maimonides says very clearly, many centuries before, if a guy comes, and even if he does miracles, and he knows all the Torah, he says, change one letter of Torah, you kill him as a false messiah. In 1666, Shabtai Tzvi goes to the Sultan of Turkey and demands the Sultan recognize him as the Messiah. Okay, the Sultan throws him in jail. And a lot of the followers start to freak out, but they figure, what? Ah, this is the final test. Just like, you know, Lubavitcher Rebbe, right before, you know, he goes into a coma, but he's going to come out of it and he's going to reveal himself. A year later, 1667, the Turkey gives Shabtai Tzvi a choice. Convert or die. Okay? And what does Shabtai Tzvi go to do? He converts. Okay? And the entire Jewish world is like, boom. Anyone who believed him. He's even given a royal title, Aziz Mehmed Efendi. And he's given a position, keeper of the Sultan's gate. He still has messianic potential, so the Sultan basically puts him in exile. And he dies in exile. But he lives out his life as a Muslim, and many of his followers convert with him, which is a huge disaster. And the rest of the Jewish world has suffered like a huge stomach punch. All the wind has been knocked out of us. Like, oh my, this is it. We thought he was here, he's not here. And now when we get to this period of time, right, mid-17th century, we see after everything has happened, the massacres of Tach V'Tach, another great false messiah, where are we holding? This is going to set the...